So as I was saying earlier, the retreat that Terry and I co-led last weekend had to do with what appears to be a seeming paradox. On the one hand, the importance of understanding, acknowledging, accepting the truth and the totality of who we are, however it is that we choose to identify ourselves, to take pride in ourselves just as we are. And when necessary, to be able to rise to the defense of who we deem ourselves to be. On the other hand, the Buddha teaches us the importance of being able to understand and not buy into what he called identity view. One of his observations on this topic is, he said, whoever you conceive yourself to be, the truth is never thus. Whatever you conceive the world to be, the truth is never thus. The key word in that saying is conceiving. Okay. So if you conceive of yourself as a particular entity, somebody with a fixed identity, okay, that is never ultimately the truth of who you are, because it's a construct of the ego. The same is true of the way we perceive the world. Okay. If we perceive the world, we tend to perceive the world in a certain way, corresponding to what our needs happen to be at the time. Just like almost every other member of the animal kingdom, our nervous system organizes all sensory input into three categories: that which we find beneficial, that which we find threatening, and that which we don't care about. Excuse me, spring allergies. And he tells us, if you see the world and you see and understand yourself only through the lens of self, only through self-conception, or what he called conceit, self-conceiving, you'll never be able to see things as they truly are. So in order to obtain freedom, we have to learn to find a way to relate to ourselves and to relate to the world that does not have to go through the filter of self-conceiving. And yet, as we come into the world, okay, it seems as if that's what our consciousness is designed to do, right? The Buddha, one of the metaphors that he used for self, self-conceiving, was not really a negative or pejorative one. He likened coming forth in the shell of self just as an egg being laid. And then it becomes the task of the chick inside the egg to grow and eat the food that's provided within the egg as the egg thins and becomes more brittle. And it's the responsibility of the hen who's warming the egg to incubate it to the point where the chick can come to maturity and then finds the shell too confining and begins to peck at it and claw at it, okay, until it begins to break open. So the shell had a role to play. It was a vehicle that got you to a certain place in time. And then it was time to set the shell aside and come forth. Another simile the Buddha used is that of a snake. He did a whole discourse on the simile of the snake, where he said, if you note the snake, it grows an outer skin to protect itself and allow it to make its way through the world. And then at some point, as the snake continues to grow, the skin is too small and too tight and too brittle, and so it sheds it, and it grows another one, and another one, and another one. And that's basically a simile for spiritual maturity or spiritual evolution. Continuing to grow beyond the bounds of that which we've used to protect ourselves. The dominant metaphor in terms of revealing one's sort of true self or true identity with regard to sexual orientation or gender identity has traditionally been that of the closet, the structure, you know, into which the culture has confined one, until one decides that the pain and the isolation and the loneliness involved in staying enclosed is greater than the fear of the unknown of what might happen if one comes forth and reveals themselves to be who they truly consider themselves to be. I read a book once recently by an author named Jacob Tobias. It's called Sissy. And it's a memoir, and it's kind of early in life for memoir. He's like in his late 20s. But it's a memoir of growing up gender fluid. To remember, you know, there is a distinction between gender identity and sexual orientation. So in my own case, you know, I'm straight, I'm heterosexual, but I'm also gender fluid. There's a very strong feminine presence that I've just recently begun to fully acknowledge and embody. Jacob's case, he's flamboyantly gay, but he's also very gender fluid. And in his book he says, you know, I really found some problems with this notion of being in the closet, right? Because he said, absolutely, there are cultural strictures and cultural judgments that are rendered against you. But he said he felt that really the more kind of difficult dimension of being genderqueer or whatever is the shell that we develop around ourselves. Like Rumi in that poem, you know, I've lived on the lip of insanity, questioning, wanting to know answers, knocking on a door, you know. I knock on the door and it opens. I've been knocking from the inside. So he said, I think what we all do, especially if we feel threatened by the environment around us, if we're rejected for who we are, is that we build this shell, okay? And it's a shell into which we retreat when we feel threatened, but out of which we stretch and extend when we don't. And so the most important aspect of that metaphor, that dynamic, is to recognize the extent to which we have built around ourselves our own confinement. There are indeed times when such a shell or such a protection, such an armoring, seems to be absolutely necessary. When, in fact, there is a genuine threat being posed. Talking about the just use of power by the state now in politics. This presidential administration has declared all-out cultural warfare against gender and sexual non-binary people in this country. Just as some state legislatures are stripping women of their reproductive rights and criminalizing their efforts to exercise those rights. Their children dying in concentration camps along our southern border, and their families are being obliterated in the name of border security. But it's beginning to look more and more like what it really is ethnicity-based oppression and persecution. These are threats. These are real threats. Okay. These are direct threats to people like me and every other genderqueer person who's in the process of seeking to come forth and be honest about who they truly are. So if there ever was a time when we needed to rise to the defense of all who were under attack from the forces of religious extremism exercised through the power of the state, it's now. Personally, it has never been more important for me to self-identify as gender fluid and to more frequently dress the part. So how do we square this with the importance of articulating one's identity and gathering together with others in protection of our rights or dignity? And yet, at the same time, come to some terms of understanding and relationship with the Buddhist teaching about letting go. As I've said here more than once, you know, when I came out on retreat, when I came forth on retreat, out of the shadows as gender fluid, retreat with my own teachers, 2 summers ago, in a small group interview with one of my teachers, Kamala Masters, when I was bemoaning my karma in terms of what I was going to be having to work through. She said, no, you have to see that what you have is very good karma because it gives you the opportunity to inhabit both gender identities while also understanding that all identities are illusory. She's talking about the relative and the absolute. So how do we use the Dharma to understand these two things? The importance of knowing who we are and acknowledging with deep respect who we are, and also gradually being able to let go of who we think we are. There is a very wise geographer, Chinese-American geographer, now deceased, who was on faculty in the geography department at the University of California at Berkeley. And he did some really interesting work that was kind of drawn from the biological sciences on the concepts of what's called refuge and prospect. And the organization of the world into refuge and prospect is a phenomenon that seems to be almost universal in the animal kingdom. What it means is this. Nearly all of us, all animal species, especially those who are capable of moving about on the earth, seek refuge, a place of safety. A place of safety from which we can view the world, from which we can assess what's going on around us, in order to identify opportunities for food, for meeting various other needs, okay, and also to recognize and assess threats. So how do we, and again, nearly all animal species do this, and Yu Fu Chuan said that it's also worth noting that if you look at classical Chinese landscape painting, oftentimes it'll be a painting of a multi-story building set into a hillside, as seen from perhaps across a canyon or a valley, okay, an open, sort of open space. But the point of view of the observer, and this, or the one doing the painting, is at about the same elevation as the structure. So in other words, the point of view of the observer is also from a place of elevation, okay? Usually in the forest or in another building on the other side of the valley or the canyon, okay? And so his understanding and his observation was that we tend to try to organize our world in the same way. That we're always, whether it's architecture or landscape architecture, how we organize or order our relationship with our environment, is that we're always seeking those things out. A place of refuge and an ability to clearly see everything that's around us. Also comes in very handy in military strategy and things like that for other purposes. It's possible to think about the Dharma in the same way. The monk and scholar Anālayo likens the practice of mindfulness meditation, or the proper state of mind to bring to doing mindfulness meditation, is not just like some kind of neutral security camera, but rather he said, think of a kind and loving parent sitting on a bench next to a playground, and the parent's children are playing playing in the space around. Okay, and so on the one hand, the parent wants to give them free rein to explore the world and have fun, and yet at the same time to make sure that they are that they're cared for. And so when we do mindfulness meditation, what we are seeking to do is to train the mind to view the world from the place of refuge. So we seek that neutral, trusting space within us, our Dharma, right? Our understanding of what lies within, right? So we seek out that place from which to observe the world around us. If we see the mind, you know, and this is where it gets really interesting in terms of mindfulness meditation. You know, what the Buddha said is that that which we think of as self is kind of an amalgam, a compilation, an assemblage. It's made up of this physical body, and it's made up of the automatic judgments that take place as to whether we find sensory stimuli pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. It's made up of perceptions, our being able to actually identify what's going on out there, of our ability to retrieve memories related to those perceptions, and the fifth element of that which the Buddha says we think of as being self is not a thing at all. It's a process. So it's called, at least by scholars like Anālayo, the process of consciousness. So it's not like an ingredient that you mix together with the others to make self. Okay. It is, in fact, an ongoing process, a flow of energy through the world. And so the way the Buddha talks about it, that which we think of as self is nothing more than what he called these five aggregates affected by clinging, right? Wanting to be a certain way, wanting to be a certain thing. Okay. But if we can kind of unpack it a little bit, we can see that this consciousness that wants to be, wants to help construct the self, when we're doing mindfulness meditation, we can actually take, it's like taking a step above, right, in terms of refuge and prospect, and being able to watch the mind seeking to construct self. So we see consciousness flowing through the structure, nama-rupa, the body, okay, taking in these sensory inputs, and seeking to construct a self. And yet, when we're really mindful of what's going on, we're able to watch the mind do that. We're able to watch the flow of consciousness move through all that which we're aware of, okay, in the process of self-construction. So when we had our Vaisak celebration, I gave a little talk about kind of the history of Buddha Dharma as it spread throughout the world, and I briefly used an analogy of the hydrologic cycle that I think really does have some relevance here. So just as an example, we're going to be looking at storm clouds arising over the Pacific Ocean in the winter time, being blown ashore, encountering the Sierra Nevada mountains, and precipitating out moisture as snow that collects in the mountain valleys. Snow collects in this one particular mountain valley, lies there until the springtime, when it melts and flows down into the basin at the base, at the center of this mountain valley. Okay. If you get out a map of Northern California and you look at that particular lake on the map, it has a name, okay. Nama Rupa. It's called Ostrander Lake. And it has this water that's collected in it. As the snow melts at the north end of Ostrander Lake, there's a creek flowing. Okay. And if you look on the map, the name of the creek is Upper Bridal Veil Creek. Okay. So we have this structure with this moisture in it, this water in it. We call it a thing. We call it a static thing. Well, there it is on the map. Right. It's got a line around it, and it's painted blue. So what we have is structure, but we also have this flow. Okay, it's gradually flowing out of this still forest lake along Bridal Veil Creek, flowing along, minding its own business, and then what happens? It falls over a 600-foot cliff, plunges right straight down vertically into the Yosemite Valley. At that point, the water is no longer called Bridal Veil Creek. What is it called? Bridal Veil Falls. Right? As the water comes down, if the flow is a little, if it's the dry time of year, sometimes the falls don't even reach the valley floor. It's toward the west end of the valley, so it's like a funnel. There's pretty strong winds that blow through there from time to time. And so as this waterfall is coming down this 600-foot drop on this vertical granite face, the wind catches it and blows it off to one side. And that's where it gets its name. It looks like a bridal veil being swept, you know, behind, you know, this entity, right? So then it's bridal veil, same molecules of water, right? Flows down the cliffside, lands in what's then called on the map Lower Bridal Veil Creek. The ongoing flow that we now call something else. Keeping our eye on the map, what happens then is that the water in Bridal Veil Creek flows into the Merced River on the floor of Yosemite Valley. You know, bubbling, boisterous river flowing through the valley, down out of the high Sierras, white water, vigorous, beautiful, powerful, tearing its way down the mountainside. Okay. And then flowing out into the California Central Valley. All the time this water has been flowing down, from the lake to the creek to the falls to the creek, the river, it's been picking up things along the way. It's been picking up minerals, it's been picking up organic matter and then depositing it to create habitat for, you know, reeds and things like that that then create habitat for beavers, and then it gets further on down into the Merced and river otters, and so it's moving along carrying all this matter that makes life possible as it flows along. Eventually, the Merced down in the California Central Valley flows into the San Joaquin River. San Joaquin River drains the entire southern half of the California Central Valley. Most of that valley is devoted to agriculture and livestock raising and some oil fields. I'll give you one guess as to whether what the water is carrying when it's plunging down out of the Sierras and the Merced is the same stuff it's carrying when you get to the lower San Joaquin River. If you were a conscious molecule in the water at that time, you would notice that you had company. You know, that there were phosphate and nitrate pesticide molecules. And there were pathogens from the cow shit. And there were all kinds of nasty pesticides. And at some point, the water becomes such that fish can no longer survive in it, okay? So now and then, every once in a while, you find a belly up fish floating along as well, right? Not the same body of water, but it's the same water, right, or not? Because it's in continuous flow. Okay. Then eventually, the San Joaquin flows into the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta. Okay. Thousands and thousands of acres of wetlands. Okay. With all kinds of plant life, rich environment for various species of wildlife, but the plant life there also has the effect of actually filtering out a lot of the schlock that the San Joaquin River's been carrying. Okay. Then eventually, the water flows through the delta, and all of a sudden it's carrying a lot of salt molecules, right? Because it's flowing into the Carquinez Straits, that's flowing into the San Francisco Bay. And so the fresh water and the salt water are mixing. And then eventually that water flows out under the Golden Gate Bridge with the outgoing tide, back out into the ocean. By this time it's summer, and there are summer thunderstorms that draw the water up out of the ocean in clouds, take it ashore, and drop it on the Sierras once more. So, the reason I've gone to such lengths is that I invite us to think about what's actually going on with us in somewhat the same way. The Buddha says we're self-conceiving all the time, round and round and round and round. Okay. So if we think about our consciousness flowing through these various shapes and structures, you know, the serenity of the clear blue mountain lake, and then all of a sudden the bubbling stream, and the magnificent falls, and the creek again, and the river, the gorgeous, you know, tumultuous whitewater river, and then it flows into the San Joaquin. Oh, not quite the same, right? And then eventually back out into the ocean and back out into infinity. If in fact, as the Buddha says, we're self-conceiving all the time, how we go about the self-conception process depends on what the consciousness is encountering along the way. So there may be times when we feel liberated and bright and energetic and enthusiastic. You know, we're the upper Merced, or we're Bridal Veil Falls, you know, and we identify with being Bridal Veil Falls or the upper Merced. And then there are times, if you're really paying attention to what the consciousness is flowing through, you start running into the fertilizer and the cow shit and the dead fish and the pesticides. It's like, ooh, you know? I don't like being the San Joaquin River. Well, that's okay because you're not. You know? What's happening is at that point in time, consciousness is flowing through that particular set of causes and conditions. How do we know that we're not, you know, we do not, you know, we like to self-identify as Bridal Veil Falls or Ostrander Lake or the Upper Merced. We don't want to identify as the Lower San Joaquin. Okay. How do we know that we're not really any of those things? mindfulness. Mindfulness is like a kind of a water spirit hovering over the entire cycle, you know. And it can see whatever's going on, whatever was going through your mind while you were sitting tonight, right? You can think of it as your consciousness carrying along whatever causes and conditions are feeding into it this evening. You know, whatever is flowing into this stream of consciousness in this body, in this form that we're in. So that model works, you know, as something that's happening continuously and quickly, and that the consciousness can find itself at different places in this cycle at different times, sometimes very quickly. Okay. You can also use that model to think about a lifetime. That at different times in our lives, we had a different shape, different form, different level of energy, different level of experience, different level of enthusiasm, different level of knowledge, of knowing. A different mixture of who we are. Okay. So even when we're down in the San Joaquin or the Delta, we can still remember when we were Bridal Veil Falls or when we were Ostrander Lake. You know. If we really have the big picture in mind, then we also have that understanding as, well, you know, I may be that lake again sometime. Or the falls. Or the river. Or the Delta. Or the bay. Okay. So the value of the practice that we do is such that allows us to see what we are and what we are not. That what we are is this flow of consciousness, this knowing factor. Now, and just like the water is being drawn down by gravity, and by the shape of the land, okay, and by additional precipitation that runs the water through the course, okay, we can see these forces at work, but we also know that we are not them. That's how it becomes possible to put the two side by side, to know there are times when it's really important to be the Merced River for a little while, you know. Or there are times when it's really important to be the Delta, you know, as yucky as it might seem, because it's performing this vital filtration process. You know, it's making the water clean again. So it's a matter rather of just seeking to be able to recognize who we are at any one point in time, rather than trying to cling to one identity or thrust away another one because we find it attractive or we find it unattractive. It's simply watching the flow as it goes on and recognizing that there are times when, you know, like Ron Dass used to say, it's especially when people were, you know, doing drugs in addition to meditating. You know, it's all very well and good to call God, but don't forget your zip code. You know, it's, and again, he was talking about the relative and the absolute. You know, it's important to stay grounded at the same time that you're allowing the mind to open to possibilities. When on the retreat where I came out, I would tend to dress different ways at different times of the day. Like, get up in the morning and do exercise, do sit walk, and then decide it was really time to really go out for a hike. And so I'd go into pretty deep samadhi, and then I'd open my eyes, and I was wearing cargo shorts and a shirt, and I'd get up and go off for my walk. Later on, usually in the afternoon or the evening, is when I, you know, take a shower and clean up, and then really free the feminine presence to come forth. Especially toward the end of the retreat, when the concentration was getting quite deep, and it became possible to for the mind to get calm enough and relaxed enough to where it actually ceased constructing self. Okay. At the end of the sit, the bell would ring, and I would open my eyes, and I'd be surprised to see who I was because I hadn't remembered what identity I'd taken on before I sat, you know. So it's that. It's very consciously putting together a certain way of being for a certain purpose, but then also remembering that that's what we're doing. There was a Tibetan Dzogchen meditation master that I sat with, sat several retreats with, named Sokni Rinpoche. And he was talking about the things that he takes delight in, you know, the things that he was encouraging us to as well, you know, that don't feel like you can't have a good time this life, you know, relish, enjoy what's there, and be respectfully with that which you find difficult to bear. And he talked about how much he loved to watch movies. He would just get completely engrossed in them, you know, and just, look what's gonna happen to her, what's gonna happen to her, are they gonna fall over, are they gonna fall out of love, are they gonna stay together, you know, who's gonna win this battle? And he would just get completely sucked in. And I know somebody asked him in a small group where we had about Sokni Rinpoche, you know, it's all illusion. And he said, of course it is. Of course it is. That's what makes it entertaining. You know? He said, what's the value if you can't get sucked in? He said, the trick is you simply have to always remember it's an illusion. Enjoy it. And he's basically talking about the same thing when we're selfing away. You know, well, great. Be the bridal veil falls. Take pleasure in it, you know. Even pretend that's really who you are. But you better watch out, because sooner or later you're going to wind up in the San Joaquin. You know, so it's like, just realize that it's something we do. It's not who we are. Same model also equally applies, because the dynamics are just the same in the realm of rebirth. But that's a talk for another time, maybe next week. Okay. So remember the metaphor. Meanwhile, how about some discussion? How about some questions, comments? Yes, please.
I was listening to how you mentioned shedding your skins, trying on different versions, so to speak, and kind of brings it back to monks. They shave their heads, take away anything that's self, ego, try to shed. I kind of wondered if maybe that in order to kind of shed self, we almost have to get rid of what we have, which I'm not ready to do, obviously, but just something I think about.
Thank you. Right, that's the practice. And I was at a teacher training retreat once with a very well-known and highly regarded Western monk, one of the foremost translators of Theravada texts into the English language, named Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he is a 230 precept monk or whatever. And we asked him about that. You know, does it really have the desired effect? You know, are you really able? He said, you would not believe how monks are able to self-conceive. The mind is shameless and it will wrap around anything. You know, like the quality of the robes you're given, you know, by the yogis, you know, or the quality of the food that you're given, or whether somebody has a fancier begging bowl than you do. He said, it's embarrassing, because the whole purpose of living this life is to strip away all these things that we covet, you know, and that we take pride in and whatnot. But he said it's basically just an opportunity to observe at a much finer level of detail how the mind seeks ceaselessly to try to go about bringing forth self. But it's an extraordinarily fine practice, and it brings that sort of thing sharply into view. Thank you. Please. Yes.
So when you said it's ceaselessly working to create this sense of self, and that's out of trying to protect us, and so is the duality that you're talking about is sometimes we need that, and sometimes it's good to let go of it.
Yes. One of the ways it's been described is mindfulness puts us in continuous dialogue with our own evolution, you know, because the hard wiring that I was talking about is something that's pretty universal within not only the animal world, but the vegetable world. You know, seek opportunity, avoid threat, and, you know, just screen out everything else. It's what the mind does. It's just, okay. And we wouldn't be here as a species if we weren't good at it, right? And yet, I think that the point that's being made is that because of our mental capacity, the mind goes into overdrive. If somehow or another decides that's all there is, and that's all, you know, that's all the mind is capable of and all we need to be doing, or all we should be doing. When in fact, it's just a little bit. When we go on retreat, one of the things we do is take what's called the precepts, the five precepts, and stripped down basically, and these are also rules for living in community. The Buddha recommended for people who are not monastics. Don't kill stuff, especially each other, or a monk, or a nun, right? Because that'll send you, go around a lot of times in the San Joaquin if you do that. don't take stuff that isn't yours, right? Don't hit on each other. Don't engage in, you know, sexual misconduct. Don't lie. You know, just tell each other the truth as kindly as you can. And if you're going to try to practice mindfulness, don't get loaded. You know, don't ingest things that make it not possible to be mindful. And basically that's it. So we take these precepts when we go into retreat. And it's basically promise we make to each other. You know, we co-create this place of refuge or place of safety. So we've kind of promised each other that we will treat each other with kindness, that we'll take care of each other, make sure that we're all safe. You have lodging, you have food. So all these basic needs have been seen to. And yet even with that, what we watch the mind do is go back to Paleolithic times. You know, it's still worried about, you know, threat and opportunity and not much else. And so it's an opportunity to just watch the mind doing that. You know, how we judge the world in terms of what we like and don't like, how we judge ourselves in terms of what we like and don't like, you know. And by virtue of doing that, how we create a self. What happens when we are able to watch that with enough care, loving kindness, is that we can see that it's really nothing more than a habit of mind. And that as the mind becomes more relaxed and at ease, occasionally it starts to become possible for the mind to cease doing that. So, sometimes what's called momentary nirvana, or kind of a flash, you know, of experience of not-self. This monk, Analio, that I recently sat with, he said, one way to describe that is the conscious experience of the cessation of consciousness. that the consciousness has ceased to flow through these channels, you know, that we call self, because we have relaxed the mind to the point where the flow has literally ceased. So there is no consciousness, there is no body, there, you know, the mind has ceased creating it all. Right? And once you recognize that's happened, then if you do a lot of practice, eventually that happens again and again, and then it begins to inform your worldview a little bit and begin to see, oh, I am not that. I'm not that. You know, I am this flow of consciousness through these forms, through these causes and conditions. And when I'm mindful, I'm able to watch that flow from above.
But you still have a zip code.
But you still have a zip code. And it's nice, you know. I happily remember where I live. So there's a good chance I'll get home tonight. Very useful. Please.
This is probably for another discussion, but how does personality, our behavioral tendencies that we develop over time, how does that fit into concept?
Yes, yes, no, that's a good one. Again, using the metaphor of the hydrologic cycle, right? Let's say at any given point, you know, along the river, the things that are in the river, the things that consciousness is carrying along, are dependent on what is going on upstream. So whether it's an oil field or a feedlot or a wheat field or whatever, the runoff from those sources is combining in your flow of consciousness at that point in time. And you can think about those tributaries, those contributors to whatever is in your flow of consciousness, to the entirety of your karma in this lifetime. Anything that's happened to you over the course of your lifetime, for better or for worse, something you found enormously richly satisfying and beautiful, or something that you found horrific and painful. Okay, the residue of those experiences flows along in one's consciousness. And so, I get to stretch the analogy a little bit. What happens, you know, if you're carrying along a lot of stuff that you kind of wish you weren't, but you are anyway, it's like that observation Jack Kornfield makes, that doing this practice involves giving up all hope of ever having had a better past. You know, you just have to kind of go with whatever has been fed into your stream this time around. And you do come to places like the Delta that make it possible to start filtering those things out. So even though you have the memory of them, you no longer carry the load of them. They're not toxic like they used to be. You know, they're not as painful to carry as they were before. And eventually they lose their charge and they fall away. So in that way, we carry along with us pretty much every important thing that's happened to us. Our conditioning by our parents. So we have these, in terms of Buddhist psychology, we have these predilections, you know, that the mind may be mostly inclined toward fear and aversion, right? Always rejecting things. It might be mostly inclined toward grasping, craving, and clinging. Or it might be mostly inclined just to trying to block everything out, you know. So the mind's, the forces, the powers, the energies of the mind, you know, of attachment, aversion, and delusion are mixed in there along with everything else. But then through mindfulness, as we're able to see those influences exerting themselves, then that's the detoxification process. That's the purification process. And they begin to just settle out, not be part of the flow anymore, or at least not as noticeable a part. Is that responsive?
Yeah, I'm absorbing it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's helpful.
Good, good. Thank you. Okay. Well, we've just about gobbled up another perfectly good 2 hours. So let's take just a moment and settle back into our sitting posture. We live in illusion in the appearance of things. There is a reality, and we are that reality. But we do not know it. When we understand that this is so, we see that we are nothing. And that being nothing, we are everything. That is all. Nice evening. See you next.